Random House Audio presents Calling Invisible Women by Jean Ray. Read for you by Colleen Marlowe. Chapter 1. I first noticed I was missing on a Thursday. Red and I had already been for our walk, and he went to sleep on the bath mat while I was taking my shower. Red is a Karen Terrier. He's bath mat size. After the shower, I was standing in front of the mirror in a toweling robe brushing my teeth. When I looked up, I was gone. It didn't startle me at first, not exactly. I thought it was just some trick of the light, a fog that had built up on the mirror. But when I wiped my sleeve over the medicine cabinet, I still wasn't there. My toothbrush was there, floating by itself several inches out from the cuff of my robe. And the robe was there, the collar and shoulders filling out the bottom of the mirror's frame. But I was missing. I moved from side to side a couple of times, trying to fit myself back into the picture. But all I saw was the open shower curtain behind me, the tiles of the tub, the built-in shelf that held the shampoo and conditioner. I spat out the toothpaste, and there it was in the sink, looking exactly like toothpaste. That was when I thought, stroke. Pieces of my vision were missing, even though I couldn't imagine what kind of stroke would just remove a face, a neck, a hand. Leaning forward toward the mirror, I gently tapped my invisible fingers against my invisible cheek, and what had once been a finger was stopped by what had once been a face. Curiosity was quickly being replaced by a rising wall of panic. I was 54 years old, and I was gone. Red? I said, trying out my voice. Unlike the rest of me, my voice was still there. Red lifted his head from the bath mat and looked straight at me, his brown eyes bright and full of recognition. He wagged his tail, thinking that maybe I wanted to go for another walk. Tentatively, I held out my invisible hand to him, wondering if I was dead, and if I was, what effect it would have on the poor dog. But Red sniffed the place where my hand should have been and gave it a couple of licks. I felt the rough wash of his tongue working over my phantom wrist, which I took to be a good sign, and so I went back to the mirror again. Still not there. I went into the bedroom feeling lightheaded, or feeling like someone who didn't have a head, and sitting down on the edge of the bed, which gave a creak of recognition, I picked up the phone and dialed the back line number at Arthur's office. I suppose that any day one finds oneself to be invisible was not going to shape up to be a lucky day. So when Arthur's nurse, Mary, answered, I shouldn't have been surprised. Arthur has three nurses, and getting Mary on the phone was the definite equivalent of drawing the short straw. Dr. Hobart's office, she said, impatient from the start. Mary, it's Clover. I need to speak to Arthur. I was struggling not to hyperventilate. I could see her shaking her head. He's in with a patient. Is there something I can help you with? Maybe she thought I was calling in regard to a sick child, even though she knew that Nick was 23 and Evie was 20. Can you get him for me? He has patients waiting in all five of the exam rooms, with 14 more in the waiting room. Her voice was both flat and brisk. He's in with the mayor's wife now. Their second grader has a rash. It could be a tick bite. We've got a vomiting toddler in room 3 and a first-time mother in room 1 who has brought in a week's worth of used diapers that she has been refrigerating because she thinks the stool is inconsistent. I get it, I said, though there was nothing even notable about her report. This was Arthur's day, all day, every day, from the minute he walked in the door of his office until the minute he left. And even when he left, much of his work managed to follow him home. I understood it was her job to protect him in any way possible, to use herself to create a human shield between him and the world. But I never did appreciate the fact that she applied that same shield against me. I almost never called the office. Is it an emergency? Mary asked. It is. Okay, she said, but I could tell she had already been distracted. I could hear a shrill screaming in the background, and then, abruptly, the line went dead. So there I was, the phone levitating in midair. I stared at it for a minute before hanging up. Even if I'd gotten Arthur on the line, he no doubt would have told me that children don't become invisible, and so he wouldn't know anything about it. Arthur had a way of making it sound like he had attended some special sort of junior medical school at which he had received absolutely no information whatsoever about the human body past the age of 16. It was his means of deflecting grown-ups who casually hit him up for Adderall prescriptions at dinner parties. But it also meant he never was much of a help to the adult members of his own family. And who's to say I was invisible anyway? If I was cracking up, if I'd just suffered some sort of cerebral hemorrhage, I would in fact be a poor judge of the situation. I tightened the belt on my robe and I marched up the stairs to Nick's room, Red right behind me. I could feel my bare feet against the floor. Nick is our oldest, and I opened the door to his room without knocking, because he had gone away to college and stayed away for almost 2 years after graduating. I had made his room my office. A desk, a lamp, a chair. My mother had made my room a sewing room when I moved away. Now my computer was back in the kitchen. Nick, I said to the man who was sleeping face down and shirtless in a pile of crumpled sheets. Nicky, wake up. When he didn't wake up, I took hold of his heel with my invisible hand and shook it. I could see his entire leg turning back and forth inside the flannel pajama bottoms I had bought for him 2 Christmases ago. I could feel the heat of his heel in my palm. Red jumped into the bed and stood for a moment on Nick's back. In our household, only Red had experienced unequivocal joy at Nick's return.
What?
He said into his pillow. It wasn't quite 8 in the morning. It was, for Nick, an unseen hour. I need you to look at me.
You look fine, he said.
Or I think that's what he said. He hadn't lifted his head. I flicked the switch to the overhead lights, and then I went to the windows and snapped up the rolling shades. With admirably quick reflexes, Nick drew himself into a ball and howled the howl of all vampires exposed to sunlight. In the light, I could see that the room, which I had told him he would have to clean himself when he moved home 6 months ago, had not been cleaned. He scrunched his pillow down over the back of his head while Red buried his nose into the covers in search of Nick's nose.
What?
He cried either to me or the dog. I need you to tell me if you can see me. I was trying to keep my voice steady, but I could hear the panic. He rolled over, blinking in my general direction. The light was burning his eyes. He pressed his chin down to his chest, lengthening his neck like a turtle.
What's this about?
Do you see me?
You don't like your bathrobe anymore? You want to know if it's becoming? I don't know what you're asking.
How can you not know what I'm asking? Am I here? Nick had been a history major at Oberlin, and though we had begged him to consider a minor in business, he had gone for women's studies instead. Women's studies, he informed us at the time, was a brilliant way to meet girls.
Are you having some sort of breakdown?
I might be. My robe was shaking.
If you feel like I don't appreciate you, well, he said, rubbing his eyes, it's because I don't. I will again, but not until at least 10, okay?
He put his arm over the dog and pulled him in tight like a wide receiver ready for a 40-yard run.
Please pull the shades on your way out.
That was when I turned and looked in the mirror over his dresser. There I was, my hair dripping and uncombed but recently touched up for gray. My cheeks bright red from a combination of fear and rosacea. I was back. So completely and utterly returned, it was as if I had never been gone at all. Maybe it was just some weird aphasia. Except instead of a temporary loss of speech, I had experienced a selective loss of vision. As I dried my hair and put on the little bit of makeup that I associated with my own human dignity, I stared hard at my reflection, checking for any fuzziness or missing spots. Even after I was dressed, I kept going back to the mirror to make sure I was still there. I couldn't spend more than 2 minutes away. Sure, I could see my hands, my legs, but was my face still there? My neck? Back I would go to check again. Spending a morning staring at oneself was hardly the short path to peace of mind. It was the mirror, after all, that had driven Snow White's stepmother around the bend with its unrelentingly frank assessment of the situation. Soon my worry about invisibility had been replaced by a cataloging of flaws. My eyelids were drooping in a weird way that made my entire face look asymmetrical, and the crease between my eyebrows made me look as if I'd been struck in the forehead by a very small axe. And my mouth? Where had my lips disappeared to over the years?
I preferred the picture of myself I kept in my imagination. The one in which my hair could...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?